Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
The Freeze Lecturers continue on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, excuse me, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And a not much better voice, I'm Todd Wooten. Dr. Lauren Hammond will speak clearly, though, today on the 1619 Project on Scribble. It's the weather.
Who knows?
Has to be the way. Well, you know, this is one of those things, Lauren. We turn on the recorder and we go for 30 minutes, and whatever happens, happens.
Okay, I'm game.
Unless, of course, you say something that gets us barred by the FCC.
Oh, no. Then we'll start over.
Well, but you picked did you pick this book, by the way?
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't.
I didn't. No. It was actually a request for me to speak on the book, and I got it probably about this time last year. Okay. Kai Swanson asked me if I would be interested in participating in the series, and if I would in particular be interested in doing the 1619 Project, and I was really excited and jumped at the chance to say yes and participate in the series. Yeah.
Well, excellent.
But then you had to read the book.
Yes.
And all the commentary. There was a lot of commentary.
Yeah, so read the book, read a lot of the different feedback, listened to some of the podcast. But a great book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And despite some of the controversy that it has been embroiled in, I definitely think that it's a book that changed, or maybe we might say is changing history. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, as a Southerner, I know the face of that racism up close. And it has been an agony to me all my life, not only to see what it was then, but to be aware of what it was like in the beginning and what a horrendous institution slavery was in this country, mm-hmm. How unendingly brutal. And then the attempt of the South to keep it going even after they had lost the Civil War, at least in terms of opportunity and education and so on.
Indeed.
So to go back and to examine the whole thing from 1619 forward, I think is one of the most useful things that's been done.
Mm-hmm.
But oh my.
Well, when you spoke at the Freeze Lecture, how'd you focus? What did you decide as a starting point for something that big?
Well, one of the things that I really kind of wanted to start with, because the book has had so much controversy, is hearing, one, whether or not people had actually read or listened to the project, and so kind of had an educated sense right from their own engagement with the text. Then the other thing I was interested in seeing was what people heard, positive, maybe we might say in the middle, right? Positive critique, positive construction. And then all the way to kind of the negative end of the spectrum. So that's what I started with. And we talked a little bit about the text author, the origins of the project, the goal and the central thrust, mm-hmm. The argument that they essentially make is that slavery and its legacy have really profoundly shaped modern American life. And despite that being true, in many ways that has been hidden from the wider American public. So we talked about that, and then we went on to talk about the reception of the text, and then maybe some of the ways in which the book has changed history, and then we just kind of did a fun question and answer session.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it was really enjoyable.
How did this book come to be? The 1619 Project. I heard it was a project of the New York Times. Is
mm-hmm,
that right?
Mm-hmm. So that is true. So when you read the introduction to the text, she talks about when she was in high school, she took a class called the African American Experience and came across that date, 1619, in terms of it being kind of the inauguration of the African American presence in the United States. And think that she really carried that with her. It's something that was seminal. And so she goes to school for journalism, launches her journalism career. But as we approached 2019, right, the 400-year commemoration, her thought was, I wonder what people might do, right? Will people even recognize this as an important date in the American narrative? Mm-hmm. And wagering that probably not, she approached the New York Times with the idea of pitching the 1619 Project, really to get the United States to think much more critically about its history and the role of African Americans in it.
Mm-hmm. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Is history, yes.
Yeah. History's still unfolding. I mean, it's only been a few years, really. Mm-hmm. So it's still new.
And who is the author?
Nicole Hannah-Jones is the editor and maybe we might say co-creator, but there are a number of other journalists, activists, scholars who have contributed individual pieces both to the original form, right, kind of that I believe was 9-part kind of like essays that I think are still available on the New York Times website, and then also now a long-form book which has been much expanded, at least 13 or 14 chapters now.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it still keeps growing, huh?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed it does.
That's amazing. What about the book do you think is most valuable to a person who goes into this with no awareness of what's at stake?
Well, I think probably just that, the increased awareness of the African-American story. So depending upon where we are in U.S. history, African-Americans have been anywhere between roughly 25% to about 15% of the population. And I think it's pretty troubling that most people know very little about African-American history. It's often sidelined in K through 12 education. Mm-hmm. The best chance most folks will get it is if they choose to take a course once they get to college. But by and large, K through 12 history of African-Americans is slavery, which is very bad, right? Which, of course, it was. There's a mention of Frederick Douglass, maybe. Then there's an acknowledgement, normally brief, of Jim Crow. And then we move to Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. And that's kind of the Black American story. And so this really gives us a much better understanding of the detail, but also, again, going back to the idea that slavery and its legacy have been central in creating the United States, which I think for many was a controversial and very troubling idea.
Yeah, that's true, because most people don't know, and they're not aware of the depth of racism that flows through the whole country. And when I came up from the South, I thought, well, I'll be rid of this now. I'm going up North. And I found, no, it's just a different flavor up here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. And it's actually, people aren't aware of it. They aren't aware that they're acting on a racist basis on some things.
Yeah, it gets sneakier in some ways. I was thinking about the Obama presidency and how quick a lot of our population wanted to say, well, look, see, things aren't that bad anymore. We've elected a Black man for a president. And to convince people now that the problem is still as large as it is I don't know what word to use. It just seems trickier or sneakier somehow.
I know when I voted for Obama, I thought I'm helping kick off a wave of racism in this country.
Get rid
because
of it.
People down South, and many up North, will suddenly think there's a Black man. But not only that, but a Black woman is the First Lady. There are Black children in the White House. And sure enough, the number of hate groups doubled in that first year.
Yeah.
It was not unexpected, but it was sad to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think for many people, the Obama presidency was what they thought was the beginning of a post-racial American dream. But I think that we could even see over the course of the campaign, right, in terms of people questioning his citizenship, that we weren't at that moment. So for me, it was interesting in the aftermath of his election to hear rhetoric about us being in a post-racial America, because I was like, no, we aren't.
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, you think about it, and we've got, I think about women getting the right to vote, and suddenly, you know, okay, that's balanced. What are women complaining about? You know, and there you are saying, we don't make as much as, you know, the other part of the population. And yeah.
Well, I'm here under a false flag. I bought the book, I haven't read it. It's like many books that I should read that just pile up. How closely do you find the brutality of the slave system depicted in the book?
So I do think she does a good job of depicting it, but one of the critiques that's been mentioned by other historians is that perhaps her description is something that's more akin to what was actually happening post-revolution. That it kind of more her description maybe mirrored a bit more the antebellum period in the lead up of the Civil War. I would agree with maybe in the particulars that that's true. But by and large, slavery in any place and any time is not a great, nobody ever wants to, that's one of the, you know, when I sometimes talk to other groups or students, I'm like, you know, nobody ever wants to be in that position. Mm-hmm. And so that there tells you
something
about the nature of it. So, I think regardless of the time period, slavery is a horrible institution that nobody wants to be forced into.
There are some stories of what happened at that time and even afterwards. I was appalled as a young man to realize that horrible things were going on in Mississippi. You could run over a black man on a country road and nothing would ever happen. Nothing would ever be said. The brutality was breathtaking. And the lynchings continued up until, I think, in the 1980-something. Yeah, it's... And I've often wondered, how can a people be so gentle and tender and brutal at the same time? It just didn't make sense to me.
You mean humanity in general?
White Southerners.
Yeah.
They're the nicest,
I see.
They're the nicest people you can meet. But I tell you, the brutality in the place is just staggering.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's maybe one of the challenges folks had with the text, is that most people have no familiarity with the levels of brutality, not only of slavery, right, but Jim Crow.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have a sense of that brutality, it becomes very easy to be dismissive of not only this text, right, but the African-American experience in general.
Sure. Dismissive and defensive, you know, certainly for the white population who don't want to hear.
Is there a part of this book you'd like to read to give us an example of what's in there?
Let's see. Well, it's a really interesting text in many different ways, right? Because not only do we have the chapters, right, the kind of more scholarly essays, but they're also, it's almost like a timeline with bits of information about important historical events, poetry, beautiful, beautiful photography. And so let me see if maybe I might
read one of those little excerpts.
Let's see if
I was thinking, I saw a list of the poets that were involved in the project since I teach poetry, and it was just illustrious, you know. When I saw that, I thought, oh, that's great, that it becomes a collage kind of.
All righty. Let's see. Let's maybe read 1682. And so this is interesting for me because I'm also Southerner. I'm from Virginia originally. And so 1682 actually talks about interracial marriage in Virginia.
Okay.
So Virginia's House of Burgesses makes interracial marriage punishable by imprisonment. Over the next decade, Virginia and other colonies continue to pass laws restricting or prohibiting marriage between white and black people. No such laws exist in England at that time. They are unique to the North American colonies and help create a racial caste system that strictly forbids interracial relationships of all kinds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's down around New Orleans, things were a little bit more relaxed. And you did have those relationships, but it was relatively late that New Orleans turned hard racist. And I remember Louis Armstrong was always happy to go to New Orleans because it was easy and free, but he went back there once in later years, and he swore he'd never go there again because of the way things had changed. So it ebbs and flows, and it depends on so many different things. But the thing, the aspect of slavery in this country is that there had been slaves before. People were captured and made slaves, all kinds. Britons were made slaves in Rome and so on. Generally, you had a way to work out of that. But in this country, it became associated with blacks. And that association, that stamp, had a disfiguring effect on history. And so the two, skin color and slavery, became intertwined. Which, you know, had not been so before.
So who was punished? Were they punished equally in interracial marriages?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. It often depended. And so one thing maybe to keep in mind is that while interracial marriage may have been outlawed, that didn't mean that interracial unions were not still taking place and occurred across the spectrum.
Yeah.
You know, some definitely much more coercive, akin to rape and sexual assault.
Yeah.
Some where, you know, maybe there may have been elements of positive feeling, but because there often was still a issue of power dynamics, right? There's never entirely free. So I think that's always one thing that's important to kind of keep in mind when it comes to interracial marriages. But the other thing maybe to think about is when we're thinking about interracial unions, that's really what kept slavery, particularly in the United States, going. Right? So here we've looked at the 1682 decision. In 1664, there's another decision from the Virginia House of Burgesses, which makes slavery inheritable through the mother, right? And so this is how slavery managed to perpetuate itself. And we have this very odd situation where we get men who are essentially father owners, where they both have fathered and also own their own children. And unlike in other places, right, there was not kind of a custom of frequently freeing those children, which is not super common, but more common in Latin America and the Caribbean. And so one of the things that I might argue is that this is kind of where we see the birth of two different Americas, right? One black, one white, and at the behest of owners, right, who had ties to people who were a part of the Virginia House of Burgesses, and this is the decision that they made. And I think it's so interesting because oftentimes folks who critique the 1619 Project, they're like, well, anything before 1776 is not really about the United States, right? That's about England. But as we've seen, the laws that were passed in the Virginia House of Burgesses and the equivalent in North Carolina, South Carolina, Maryland, those laws and decisions didn't come from England and didn't apply in England. So already we can see that people living in the United States are creating their own unique system.
What about the Reconstruction era? That was a brief, tumultuous time when all of a sudden former slaves could vote. They were voted into office, into Congress, various positions of power, and through a really shabby deal that was made, the Republican Party, which had been really behind the North in the Civil War, agreed that we would just let it all go if your electors would choose our candidate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that ugly bargain sealed the fate of the South from that time on.
Indeed it did. It was a compromise of, was it 1877?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it wasn't a compromise. It was a cave-in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what textbooks refer to it as, the compromise mm-hmm. of 1877.
Yeah.
But essentially, they abandoned African Americans to the South as it was entering into the phase of Southern redemption,
yeah.
right? Attempting to redeem and in many ways roll back mm-hmm. all the gains that African Americans had made.
Yeah, it's quite a history. Reading it all, do you find it depressing?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to do this kind of scholarship, to read this kind of scholarship. You know, even when I did the Freeze lectures, it was interesting to hear some of the audience members say that they actually could not finish the book because they found themselves so emotional and distraught over the text. And so it's very beautifully written, but there are hard moments.
Well,
very hard moments.
Yeah, it is sometimes hard to read things like that, but I've been through a lot of that in my lifetime reading about the South. And it was tough. I still am aghast at the brutality that was common
mm-hmm.
every day.
Mm-hmm.
I've cited before the instance where you'd bring three slaves in with bags of cotton, weigh them, and the one with the lightest bag was whipped. It didn't make any difference how much there was, and every day that would be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is inhuman,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
it was a matter of course.
Yeah.
And then there were rebellions. And they were bloody things that were put down with extraordinary violence. Yeah, it's not a history that one can be proud of in the sense, you know, the country is going forward and improving and so on. But it is important to know it.
Mm-hmm.
And people really don't want kids to know it.
Yeah, well, we don't want to talk very much about our indigenous population either, because
oh, no.
what does that say about us?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really teach that very well either. And thinking about, as you're talking about slave owners, and we still have such a kind of human trafficking, and, you know, that goes on
mm-hmm.
still.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, yeah, we don't want to look at the underbelly of how things work.
Indeed.
And it is, in part, as you're saying, because it's so painful, but nothing, that's what, that will lead to change. If you are so appalled by something and so enraged and hurt, that's where change, I think, has
what
its
was
best
your audience,
chance.
What was your audience's reaction to the questions and answers and so on?
At the Freeze lecture.
Oh, we had a wonderful discussion, particularly around some of the critiques of
mm-hmm.
the text. As we said, kind of positive, those that were actually constructive and much more about the nature of historical inquiry, all the way to those who basically argued that the text was an attempt to brainwash Americans. And then, you know, talking about education, this idea of now everybody's trying to put CRT or critical race theory into
yep.
the classroom. So
did you have much of that in the audience?
No, most people appreciated the text
good.
And thought that if maybe not this text in particular, right, that at least the impetus, right, and information
yeah.
should be taught. Now, of course, there's questions about age appropriate and
yeah.
method, right, but the ideology of just, or the idea rather, just leaving much of this out was deeply disturbing to most of the audience members.
Good.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's, but I think people would still prefer that this book just go away. They would like to overlook this and think, well, let's just start fresh. You know, we'll just forget that.
It was what it was, and now it's all different.
Yeah, and now, no, it isn't all different.
Exactly.
That's the problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the specters of slavery and Jim Crow still haunt.
Oh, yeah.
They will not go away until we have a real discussion and then reckoning and redress. And it's interesting, you know, oftentimes people are like, well, you know, slavery was so long ago. And, you know, even if people conceded that, which I wouldn't, there's still Jim Crow.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the things I mentioned during the Free series is that my husband's side of the family is from Mississippi. Right. And so left for opportunity because of Jim Crow. And so that's my father-in-law. And so there's still plenty of people who experienced Jim Crow that we should think about.
And Mississippi's a hard case. I used to spend my summers there when I was a kid. It was interesting. There was a railroad line right down the middle, and the black stores were on one side and the white stores were on the other. And you didn't cross that line. Yeah, it's living it is one thing. And it amazed me that I could, my classmates could live this and not see it. Not see it as anything extraordinary or out of the way, that this is normal life.
Yeah.
But that's quite a slog. I mean, if people pick up that book, they think, whoa.
Did you have audience members who had read it? Could you tell, or were you kind of saying, this is out there, look at your hands
some,
on it?
Some people had read at least portions of it, right? Because it's a dense text. Other people had read the podcast. And Augustana actually was sponsoring a kind of a book club for reading and then discussing the text. So I think that there have been some good efforts. Even other folks mentioned efforts in the community, churches, et cetera, reading through the text. And so it's challenging to get through, but definitely worth it.
Yeah.
Are there some parts you would recommend ahead of others that, you know, if a person looks at it and think, I don't think I can do this, would you direct them to one place in particular?
Yes. So I think I would probably direct people to Democracy, which is the first chapter, and Capitalism, which is chapter 6. And the reason that I would maybe point to those two is because I think they do an excellent job of showing how race and slavery and Jim Crow have been central to both the American political system, but also the economic system. And so even the example you gave, right, of three enslaved workers, whoever had picked the least amount of cotton being punished, that's showing the ways in which slave labor fueled capitalism in the American economy.
Keep those two recommendations in mind, the chapters on democracy and the chapters on capitalism. Well, I must say, that was quite a slog to undertake, and I'm glad you accepted the challenge.
No, I am as well.
Dr. Lauren Hammond has been our guest today. She was the second of the Freeze lecturers, and her topic was The 1619 Project, which you are free to read. And that'll do it for now. Thank you very much for joining us. Hope you'll be back next week for the next edition of Scribble.